Evening, everybody. I'm Mark Houston. I'm an alcoholic. And I was sobered up on October the 19th of 1982. And I am incredibly grateful for that. You can relate maybe to the kind of day I had. It's like standing here right now, it seems like the first time all day that I've stopped. Thank God for steps 10 and 11. You know, you can have days like that. But it's good to be back with you. We're on the home stretch tonight. I want to thank you for your hospitality. You have been kind and considerate. I hope it lasts. I'll be okay if it doesn't. But I have enjoyed this. We got up through the seventh step last week. And so tonight, I'm going to start talking about the eighth and ninth step. And wherever the Spirit takes me is wherever it's going to take me. And I think I tried to make clear with you my experience that the root of my problem is my selfishness and self-centeredness. And from that, I will go back to a drink, but my problem has never been alcohol. And our big book is very clear to us on that. Step one is not my problem. It will become my problem if self doesn't die. And we talked about the idea that prior to our third step decision, our book says that with God's help, I can be entirely rid of self. And the vehicles for doing that are steps four through nine. And there is a direct connection between the death of self and the work that we do in 4 through 9. Most spiritual disciplines or religions that I've studied have a common theme. I got to die to be reborn, the carpenter told us. The Buddha said that all suffering comes from desire. When desire is gone, all suffering ends. So another way of translating that is the self, the false self, needs to die. Virtually every discipline I've ever studied, that is a common theme. I believe that we are so blessed in AA and that we are given such a simplistic methodology in which that can happen, in which through the process of steps four through nine, I and God's help in the middle of all that, I can be rid of self, and self is my problem. Now, I've shared with some of you, I've attempted to talk to you all about the steps really from two viewpoints. One is when I first came at them, and then the second is my experience with the steps a little over 18 years sober. I do a lot of work with people that have a lot of time who had the same experience I did. Is they did some work with 1 through 9. This idea, well, I can 10, 11, and 12, and that's it. And somewhere between 5 to 30 years, they had the same experience I did. They begin to suffer severely from what I call untreated alcoholism. And my experience with that whole phenomenon is the idea that I could work 4 through 9 one time and die the death of self, I realize today, is an illusion that I bought into. And so I've attempted to try and reach really two groups of people. One is those of you who have some time, who've done some work with the steps, who perhaps are asking yourself this question. You know, maybe your program feels flat. Maybe your life feels flat. Maybe your head's starting to say the same things that mine did. Maybe the meetings are getting boring. Your sponsor's getting dumb. You know, all the things that happen when myself starts to come back. And I have shared my experience of what I do with that, which is at minimum one time a year, I resubmit myself to the first nine steps. I'm going to begin that journey probably in the middle of February again. And I don't start with just writing inventory. I start in the title page, and I go through the first three considerations again, and I get hooked to my first step experience, and my second step, and third. And then I write inventory, and then, by the way, the inventory I write, as I shared with you last week, it's not old stuff. Since 1992, I've done a tremendous amount of work with the first nine steps. So the inventory I write is current inventory. And that inventory is always a reflection of times in which I fell asleep and I thought I was Mark. That's what it is, self. Self comes back. That's what those inventories always have reflected to me. And I don't know anyone in AA, and I know some people in their 50s relative to sobriety time who do not fall asleep on occasion. And I know from my own experience, if I want to go through life with peace, power, a sense of freedom, to be effective in all the roles God has assigned, the way that I have to do that is to be as devoid of self as I can. Because life terrifies a guy like me. Last year, I came face to face with my limitations of my human experience. Now I'm 54 years old, 17 years sober. I finally woke up to the fact that I have limitations. Can you imagine that? You know, I can't run on 4 hours sleep anymore, for example. I can't sponsor 10 people anymore. I can't do a lot of the things that I used to do, and that was a rude awakening to me. And thank God I'm awake enough to see those things today, that I don't have to go through life being driven by an ego, which normally only becomes satisfied by doing something externally. Through the process of meditation, which I began in 1992, I was driven into the silence. It's somewhat paradoxical for me in terms of speaking, because it's really not anything. If you ask me to make a list of 30 things I love to do, I can assure you this wouldn't even be on the list. What I love is the silence. That's the language of the spirit. That is not the way it was when I first got sober, and for many years in AA, silence felt violent to me. Because when you're used to the chatter of 1,000 monkeys, and you're used to noise, your whole world's noise, and you walk into your house, some of you might still do this, I can give you a solution if you do. The TV goes on, the radio goes on, you're checking the answering machines, silence really bothers you. In an elevator, you'll start sweating. See? I used to have all that stuff, and today I love the silence. So, what's the connection? You get up to the eighth step and you make a list. What goes on that list is a combination of a lot of things that you saw in inventory, and when I get to the place where I'm going to make my list, I pray and I ask my Creator to show me any other harm that I have put out in the universe. One of the things I started doing 2 or 3 years ago, because I know myself, people that I interact with somewhat consistently when I get to the ninth step, if nothing comes up, and what I do is I like to visualize the person, if you will, and I like to see, is there any tension between us whatsoever? And if I sense some tension, then I'm going to call that person, and I'm going to ask about that. And here's why I do a lot of this. Here's my experience. For any of you who have unfinished amends, or you have amends in which you have not made an approach, my experience is the extent to which you have, whatever that number is, not paying back the money, whatever that is, the extent to the degree of that is the extent to which yourself is still intact. And whatever that number is the extent to which you are going to be prevented from being present to the moment. To the best of my knowledge, all spiritual practices talk about where I have experienced conscious contact is being present to now. To this moment, that's all there is, that's all there's ever been. Every past event was a now, and every future event will be a now. Unfinished amends prevents me from being present to now, because self still stays intact. And that has been my experience. The first time I went through the steps with a gentleman who really had experience with the book, and by the time we got to the ninth step, I had somewhere around 120 to 130 amends. A lot of amends. And those amends were scattered out over 7 states. I hadn't paid taxes in 7 years. There were, at that time, two ex-wives, a couple ex-fiancés. It was a long list. Employers, obviously immediate family, mother, father, brothers, sister-in-laws, a lot of pals over the years. Institutions, and I got to that ninth step, and that list looked like it looked huge, and so I went over to my sponsor, and the thing with the IRS, you know how we are, it's always about money, right? So that's what I wanted to talk. So I go over to talk to him, and I thought I would get out by using this thing of I'm going to pray for willingness. And he used to do some weird stuff with me, but this is one of the things he did. He said, I'm going to give you a surefire way to know when you're willing. I said, okay. He said, what's that? And he said, well, when you're willing, you're going to hear strange sounds. And I said, what do you mean I'm going to hear strange sounds? I said, like what? And he said, well, he said, sound like this. That's the sound of you knocking on someone's door you're going to make the amends to. I said, okay. And then he said, and he took a telephone, he dialed, and he said, and then that's you calling to set an appointment. And then he took a piece of paper and he started, he said, that's the sound of you writing a letter. That's how you know when you're willing, Mark. And then he said to me, because I told you, you like to keep a bottle of Jack Daniels around. And, you know, I'm sitting here with this big list of cards, because that's how he had me do it, and I like doing that. And then he also took the bottle, and he put that down on the table, and he said, you got your stack of cards, and you got your drink of alcohol. And he said, you tell me which of the two is easier. I said, well, I think I'll go see the IRS. So I get to the ninth step. I have to stay very, very clear. What am I doing? The ninth step gives us instructions for every kind of amends that we owe, and the instructions are very specific. I think it's interesting they start out talking about me going making amends to the man or woman I hate. That's the first instruction they give me. How do you approach a man or woman that you hate, who's done more harm than you, for example? And that's the first amend. They give us instructions on how to do that. Go to them in a helpful and forgiving spirit. Then they talk about business acquaintances, and then they talk about money. And I've noticed in the ninth step, quite often what they do is they make a reference to the fact that if you and I don't do this, we'll drink. You know, they make it around money. The money thing is real clear. It's a paragraph. It says you call, you arrange the best deal you can, and if you're afraid to do this, you're going to drink. You don't think they mean I'll drink, right? You know. Over and over, I'm told that. They talk about criminal offenses that you have to make amends for. They talk about amends that you have to make to your family. They get very specific if you've been married and committed adultery. That's different than having an affair, by the way. They get specific with you about how to do that. I love the word they use. If she suspects you've been a little wild, is the word they use, right? You know, and they tell us exactly how to do it, and then in particular they have a paragraph that gives us general guiding principles. And those guiding principles pretty much are, they remind us that you and I made an agreement at the beginning of this work to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. So I'm staying clear on why am I doing it. And they say things like, oh, you know, you got to be willing to do it even if you lose your position, go to jail. I mean, they're pretty clear in there that if you and I don't do this kind of thing that we're going to suffer some consequences. And looking back at my experiences over the years, what the consequences are is myself is still intact. My false sense of self, my self-will, my selfishness, which is the root of my troubles. So I began that journey of amends. It took me about, with the exception of two of them, it took me about probably 3 to 5 years to make all the approaches. I distinguished between making the approaches and finishing the amends. Example, it took me almost 14 years to pay back the IRS. I made the approach off that inventory 2 years ago. I sent them their last check. I've been grieving ever since. It was the most intimate relationship I've ever had. immediate family. I told you I have a specific format that I follow when I'm going to make amends. And that is, first of all, my criteria is, I've told you this before, in the sponsorship lineage I have and in this beautiful book, the most important word, based on the kind of feedback I was given, the eighth step was all. I made a list of all persons I'd harmed. I didn't like that because that meant my list got very big. All the persons, you know, what do you mean, like high school? Yeah. All the persons you've harmed. Oh, no. Yeah, all the persons you've harmed. So that's why the list got so big. And so I began making those. Initially, I was living in Colorado then. Family ones, parents are forgiving. My mother, I the format that I follow, once I set an appointment, and I did this with everybody, this is what I have to do. I follow the instructions in the book. I need to make an amends to you. I'm in the ninth step. I'll never get over drinking unless I do this. Can we set a time to do that? Yeah, I'm set a time. I did that with my mother. And what I do at that point in time is, based on my inventory work and what I brought to the eighth step, I'm very clear on the actions I took, and I have an idea of how that might have harmed people. And so what I like to tell people is, in my relationship with you, this is where I see that I'm at fault. And I get done with that. And I think this is fairly typical of a lot of mothers. They've lived it, so they don't want to hear it much in detail again. She stopped me and said that, you know, that part was not necessary. They go into details on those things. And then I like to ask a question, and here's what it is. In addition to what I've seen, is there anything I've done that has created harm? And my mother is the first one of several people who brought to my attention that what I did for day after day and year after year is I robbed her of emotional security. Now, those were not the words that she used, but that's exactly what she said. And you know, I had never once, never, I'm so selfish, not once did that occur to me. That woman, literally day in and day out for years, because I'm the kind of guy that would go a year and she wouldn't hear a word. And when a day goes by, I'm her son, that she's not thinking about me. And, boy, I tell you, and that was about the second amend I made, and I needed to see that. I would have never seen that as harm. So I asked her what I could do to set it straight. She said, stay sober and be as happy as you can be in this living in this world. And, you know, my mother died January this year, and for almost 18 years, all she ever saw me was sober and happy. She said to me one time, she said, look, I know you've been married and divorced and moved around and had car wrecks, and you just always seem happy. I said, yeah, I am. See? I did what she asked me to do. I had robbed that woman of enough emotional security in her life. I didn't need to rob her of any more. My dad was a practicing alcoholic, and I made amends to him. And I was not able to say to him the things that at least I felt I wanted to say. And then he died of alcoholism in 86. And then in either 87 or 88, I went up to his graveside and read a letter to him. As if I could have talked to him, like I talked to my pals in AA, and that was a very powerful experience. All my brothers and all those kinds of things. I can't even begin to tell you the things that happen with amends and the freedom that comes into your life. With every successive amend I made, in hindsight, I saw how much more present I was to the moment. I saw the connection between unfinished amends and my current existence, meaning as I begin to pay the money back, because it's their money, it wasn't my money. I'm just a steward of their money till it's paid back. As that began to happen, I got greater job opportunities, and I began to earn a lot more money, and I saw that connection. But the list just went on and on. I saw as I made amends to pals of mine over the years, I'd done different things. I saw that my relationships with men improved. As I made amends to the women that had been in my life, I saw that my relationships with women. So I began to see that everything was connected. Now, being down the road a little ways, there was another thing that I didn't see probably till a couple of years ago, and that is this, is my ego's sole function is to make me experience being separate from you. And as I begin to move through these amends until I reached a place, and I reached this place, in my consciousness there was not one human being on the planet that I hadn't cleaned this stuff up with. And I still, the day that that happened, I was not separated from you in any way, shape, or form, nor was I separated from my universe. And what I got to experience that day is what other spiritual books talk about, is there's nothing but oneness. There's only the illusion of separation. And that was an incredible thing to experience. I would not want any one of you in this room to miss that. Because you can relate to this. As I was going through amends, I'd go to my home group, or I'd go in situations, and it felt like some kind of curtain came down over me at times. And I felt separate from you. And I experienced fear, and I experienced all those things, and I could not understand why. And then as I went through amends, I'd be in similar situations, but that curtain didn't come down. So I began to see the connection between me making those amends. The other thing I found out experientially was, when I've harmed others, first of all, I harm myself, because there's nothing but oneness. I begin to understand that I did that stuff when I was sound asleep, dreaming I was awake. It was important for me to see that because, number one, as I stopped judging me. And number two, like everyone in this room, there's people in my life that have taken a course of action to, quote, supposedly hurt me. They didn't do that intentionally either. It gets pretty easy to make amends when you begin to understand some of the things that I'm talking about, because your ego and pride don't get involved anymore. You know, for example, my dad, who was a bad alcoholic, used to be a boxer and a fighter, physical abuse. Not once did he wake up any day and say, this is what I'm going to do to my four boys. You see? And when you start to understand that he was asleep, being driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, how can you have anything but forgiveness in your heart? Well, you see? So I begin to move through all those. I will tell you the last two from that first inventory. Because all the amends I've had to make since then are not from my past. There are amends that I've had to make since I've been sober in periods of time in which I fell asleep and thought I was Mark again. And Mark is selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid. But the last two amends were, I was dating a gal. What am I saying? That's not the truth. Let me rephrase this. I had known this gal for 2 or 3 years, a pal of mine had dated her. I was in college. I went back. I ran into her. She and I went out one time, 9 months to the day a baby boy is born. And she gave him my last name. Now, that was in 1968. I was raised in a Norwegian farming community back in Iowa. In 1968, if a woman got pregnant and you didn't marry her, what you saw in your rearview mirror was the father with a shotgun. And it wasn't open to debate in the legal system, but it's just how they did things. She and I sat down and talked, and marriage was not going to be an option at that time for me. I did the things they wanted me to do in 1968 legally, and I'd seen him one time in a courtroom. She had since gone on, got remarried, and I was still drinking somewhere along the line when he was probably about 7 or 8. I got some papers that said, want to adopt him, and I remember signing them, sending them back. So I had attempted in that first set of amends to try and find them. She had since remarried. I didn't know the name, so I'd never been able to do that. And finally, about, 3 years ago, I really began to gnaw on me, and so I got a lot more active on the internet and calling some of the people I still knew back in Iowa, and I still couldn't come up with anything. And I was at a place of there's an agency that can find people, and I actually had some pretty good information, and I think they wanted $1,200. And my book tells me that I have to be willing to go to the utmost, and literally nothing is going to happen in my life unless I'm going to do that. And so I was willing to do that, but along about that time, and this is to me how God has worked in my life, I was let go from a job I'd been at for 7 months. So I went into meditation for 3 days. Father, what do you want me to do? I want you to put your stuff in storage, go back to Colorado, spend some time with your mother. Intuitively, I knew that my mother was going to die in the next 6 months. My spirit said. So, and then at the same time, there was a 35-year class reunion going on. Back, and I'd never been to one, and so I'd been busy, you know. And I can't tell you how many times they'd call me prior to, so anyhow, I went up to Colorado. I spent a couple, and I got to tell you something else. I did not like the guidance I got. What I'm used to is I quit on Friday, I start a new one on Monday. No, put your stuff in storage, have faith in me. Okay. Because what I have to tell you, something I've learned over the years, you know, the God that I've come to know and experience is a God of love, and that's all God is, and this love is so unconditional that this love will never interfere with my will, which is a gift he gave me. So I've had a chance to practice my will, go against guidance, and I got to reap the consequences. And then, of course, I've had a chance over the years to experience following the guidance and reap those, and I can tell you which of the two I've come to appreciate better. But many times, you better have faith, because what it looks like is not a fun deal. So I went up and spent 2 weeks in, this is about amends too, I went spent about 2 weeks in Colorado and then went back to Iowa, and there was a little town about 16 miles away, which is where this woman had lived, and I was scheduled to pull into that small town, and I could not get past this town. So I stayed in a hotel there. I woke up, did some meditation, go to the courthouse, went down to the courthouse, found some records, and I found her married name. So I went to a phone book, and in that phone book there were 3 people by that name. I just looked at the addresses, small town. In the first one, no one's there. Second one, there's a guy there. So make a long story short, this guy was interesting because his first question to me, I told him while I was there, his first question to me was, are you the father of this child? And I said, yes. So he said, okay. He said, well, he lives in this town. She doesn't live here. She hasn't for several years. She and he do not speak. They haven't for over 3 years. They had a falling out. So he made a couple phone calls and found his number, my son's number. Gave it to me. Said, good luck. So I went on up to this other town, and common sense told me I needed to try and pursue the mother first. So I knew the town she was in. I called directory assistance. There were two of them. The first was disconnected. I get her in the second ring and said, you know, hello, is this so-and-so? Yeah, did you used to be so-and-so? Yeah. And I said, well, this is Mark Houston. You know, just silence. So I told her why I was calling. We wound up talking for an hour, and it was a fabulous experience. And then I gave her the telephone number of her son, who she hadn't talked to in 3 years. This is how God works. Incredible stuff. And she, you know, she said, I wish you the best. I never held any animosity toward you. I mean, it was incredible. So then what's left is my son. And I called a couple times, didn't get an answer, and I didn't think I would just leave something on the answered machine. That didn't seem quite right. Hi, this is your, you know, dad. I had 31 years, right? So I finally reach him, and he answers. And I told him who I was. And I said, you know who I am? He said, oh, yeah, I know who you were. Because she had always told him the circumstances. And so he and I had a chat for a while, and I made amends to him and gave him my telephone number, gave him my address. And that was a powerful thing. And once again, this is how God works. I am willing to make any amends that came to my consciousness. It took 17 years and a series of timing before those two took place, and I basically wound up being a uniting factor of getting those two back together, because she sends me an email about once a month and lets me know that they met and their relationship is solid again. So it's an amazing process. Those are the last two amends I had from that 127. I owed a lot of money. I had cheated a lot of employers out of money. I work for three major companies. Major companies are interesting. When you approach them and tell them you want to pay back salary and stuff like that, they do not know what to do with you. One of them, when I asked what I could do to set it right, he said, never apply for a job here again. Because I did what the book said. I took money, and I did not give you a fair day's work. I padded expense accounts, and I'm willing to do anything I can to straighten this stuff up. I had that. There are also, over the years, because I damaged myself a lot from drinking. Over the years, things would come to me. Here's another example. This is about like 3 years ago. I get to the ninth step, and I like to take about a week in prayer and meditation. God, show me anything else that I've forgotten. And I remembered back in 1969 that I had stolen a set of golf clubs. I'd gone to a party, got drunk, fell over a Volkswagen. There were a set of golf clubs in the back. I stole them, then I sold them to my aunt for $250. So I called her up, and back in those farming communities, I mean, the families are fairly close, so I had a lot of interaction. So a lot of you understand those amends. I probably had about 40, I mean, cousins, aunts, uncles, you know, and every time they'd see me, they'd say, oh, you're sober? Yeah, oh, good. So I called her, and I made amends to her. And now this is, again, how God works. My uncle at that time was having a leg removed from diabetes, and I was able to go back and spend some time there. So, but my deal is make the amends, any harm that you put out. There were many instances that came to mind for me of someone I could never find where money was involved. I took that sum of money and I donated it to various charities because it's not my money. And there's a connection between what the universe brings back and the actions that I'm describing. The peace that I had in my heart, the sense of not being separate from you, all begin to increase in me in levels that I can't even begin to tell you. My capacity to love people, all of those things. The realization that I'm no different from any of you. I didn't also wake up one morning and say, I think what I'm going to do is be a tornado in the lives of these people. I was absolutely asleep, dreaming I'm awake, going through life driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And when you live that kind of a life, you are like a tornado roaring through the lives of others. I have worked with quite a few people over the years, and I really hear some interesting things when I go to meetings on amends. And what I will tell you about that is, do not miss out on making all of your amends. Do not miss out on asking your Creator to reveal to you any harm that you put out into the universe. Don't miss out on that thing. The instructions are in the big book, and they're very, very clear to you and I. There's also a correlation I discovered between my capacity to sit in the silence, meditation, and unwritten inventory and unfinished amends. There is such a difference, it's unbelievable. I particularly like to test this with people who've been around for a while, and I'll take them back through the steps again. And they will talk about the difficulties they're having with meditation, sitting in the silence. And then they will write inventory, and they'll get up, and they'll start making these amends, and all of a sudden now they describe this meditation experience is an incredibly different experience. And the reason is steps 1 through 9 are about you getting completely free of your past to be present to the present moment, conscious contact. You see, the only place in which I can experience the power of God, which is love, is to be present to this moment. There is no other time. And if my mind identifies with the past or the future, then I'm not present to the moment. You know, those years in AA I spent dying of untreated alcoholism, I'm not drinking, and I'm as separated from you and the universe as I could have ever been. Why? Because I had a lot of unwritten inventory, which meant there was a lot of self intact, and I had a lot of unfinished amends. You know, for any of you agnostics or atheists, by default, if there is a God, if you make your amends, you'll know God. See, let me explain this another way. If God is everything and everywhere, then every one of you is a manifestation of God. So if I got something between me and you, then I got something between me and God, don't I? That's another way to say it. If nothing else, make the amends for selfish reasons, right? But go make them. The other thing I discovered in the amends process is when I have harmed other people, in many cases what I did is I robbed a piece of their heart. And I'm the only one that can give it back. I'm the only one that's got the key, see? I mean, I saw the change in my mother when I did that, and I put that back in their heart again. Okay? So don't miss out on amends. Incredible experiences. Pay the money back. It's not your money. They just want their money. Okay? 10th and 11th step. The 10th and 11th step for me have become disciplines to stay present to the moment. I first heard a man about 5 years ago. He gave a 1-hour talk in the 10th and 11th step, and he had my head spinning for a year. I realized I knew nothing about the 10th and 11th step. I just started, I began to develop a daily meditation life in 1992. My current practice, I sit 2 times a day for 24 minutes. I use a timer. I'm an athlete, so I understood discipline. Our beautiful text is I'm going to do something different, really. I'm going to start with 11. I'll go back to 10 a little bit. 10 and 11 are designed to keep me in fit spiritual condition and present to the moment, with my mind not attached to the past or in the future, which is where your mind always is. If you are sitting in this room identified with your mind, you're not here. You're either going to be in the past or you're going to be in the future. I'm 54 years old. At best, I've been here maybe 6 months of my life. Driving down the road, you drive for 2 hours, you don't even remember how you got there. You know why? Because you weren't there. See, you weren't there. They asked the Buddha one time, you know, well, what do you guys do all day? And he said, oh, we eat and we walk and we sleep. And so, well, everyone does that. He said, oh no, we are awake to the fact that we're eating, walking, sleeping. See, and I didn't understand what that meant. I absolutely know what that means today. 10th and 11th step are about going through life being awake, aware, mindful, and conscious of the present moment. See, there's a shift in your consciousness. See if you can hook on to this. When I still had self intact and hadn't done much work with 4 through 9, here's what was important to me. Where I was at, who I was with, and where I was going. That's what was important. What was I doing? Blah, 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 blah. As I begin to work a lot with 4 through 9 and begin to develop a daily meditation life and begin to know God and to know that I'm a spiritual being having a human experience, I went through a transformation, and here's what it is today. It makes no difference to me anymore, ever, where I'm at and who I'm with and what I'm doing. What makes a difference to me is am I present to wherever it is I am in this human experience. Do you see the shift in consciousness? See, my sense of self comes from in me. Doesn't come out here anymore. You see? And being present to the moment is the most incredible thing I've ever experienced in my life, beyond my comprehension. Meditation has been a key for me in everything that I'm talking about. Meditation was difficult for me in the beginning. I got a timer. I started with 10 minutes. Going to sit down. I went out and got a couple simple books. Chatter of a Thousand Monkeys. You know, someone will see you. You know, you're crazy. You know, just, it was amazing. Longest 10 minutes of my life when I first started. But see, I told some of you this, is I know what half measures are in AA. I know what half measures are with the 10th and 11th step. And our book is very, very clear. Its instructions to every one of us in this room are very clear, if you want to do them. And I hadn't. What I mean by very clear, my 11 steps gives me a bunch of prayers and says meditation. It says every day. It doesn't say it's an option. It doesn't say you can do it 5. I chose not to do that. My book is very clear with me about the 10th step. Whole bunch of things to do every day. My book's very clear about an evening review every day. And I chose not to do that, and I suffered the consequences. I went insane, almost committed suicide. So, when I got to the other side of that, because I didn't die, I said, I think I will do something different. I think I will do exactly what our book says. And I think I will do it every day. Because I don't ever want to go through that again. Some books call it Dark Night of the Soul. I know what hell on earth is. 10 years sober. I know what it is. Pain in a level I could not even describe. There was no God. There was nothing in life. It was unbelievable. Died the death of self. See, I truly could not stand myself. There wasn't anything God made that was of joy and pleasure. And yet there was no God. They call it Dark Night of the Soul. And I lived through that. And so I begin to work with those disciplines on a daily basis. Probably within my first month of meditation, I begin to have experiences with meditation. I begin to notice some things. I begin to notice I was calmer. I begin to notice I did not react so much. I responded to more things. I begin to have a sense I'd be doing something, and it's like something within me say, go do this. Or I'd get up and I'd finish my meditation and a voice, something, not a voice, but they'll lock you up if you do that too much, but they, something would say, call this person. I begin to see that it begin to impact my physical body. 95, I weighed about 250 pounds. I begin to work out a lot more. I lost a lot of weight. I could go on and on and on with the benefits of meditation. You know, and the other thing is the ability to face calamity with serenity. I begin to experience that at a level I'd never experienced before, because life's going to give you what life gives you. In being sober. I think there was a period of time in which I had this idea that being sober would place me in some little bungalow somewhere where I would be safe, secure, and insulated. And that's not my experience. If anything, you're more on the firing line. And, you know, there's a line in our big book which is very difficult to practice. It says that when you manufacture misery, which is what we do when we're being driven by self-will, when trouble comes, the trouble that you have manufactured, we want you to cheerfully, that's the word they use, we want you to cheerfully allow God to demonstrate his omnipotence to get yourself out of the trouble you created. That's very hard to do, right? Lose a job, you know, relationship. Let me make sure about that. I'm supposed to cheerfully allow God to demonstrate his omnipotence. That isn't how we do it, right? We come in and take over a meeting with telling you about how bad it is. I begin to be able to practice that. I still remember the first time that I had some pretty threatening life situation experiences happen to me, and I still was experiencing peace and joy. Now, I also didn't tell very many people that, because I thought, how do you tell someone that, right? Because you're supposed to be, so at the same time, I'm experiencing all this deep emotional pain, and I've got a bunch of peace and joy going on at the same time within me. All these are gifts of meditation. Don't miss out on them. Because our book over and over again talks about meditation. In the sex inventory, they get very specific. Matter of fact, they say, if you have a problem in this area, right, for all of us who need an overhauling here, in meditation, I ask God about each specific answer. The right answer will come if I want it, each specific problem. So our beautiful book tells us over and over again that meditation is part of our spiritual discipline. Now, here was something else I did for a while in AA. Some of you might be able to relate. The big book says that I am given freedom from alcohol by one thing and one thing only, and that is that I stay in fit spiritual condition. And what I've discovered over the years is I'm responsible for that. Here was the trap I fell into. God keeps me sober. Now, when I look back at that, that's a great belief system for me to buy into because it means I'm not responsible for anything. And if that was the truth, our big book would be one page. God keeps you sober. What I finally begin to understand is that I am completely responsible for my fit spiritual condition, and God is not. Wow. I don't know if I like that. That means I've got to do something. See? I set my alarm clock for 5 a.m. See? I spend most of the time an hour and a half in the morning with that which created me and sustains me. Because of myself, I am nothing. I trick people all the time. Particularly, you know, in AA, what's the most important thing in your life? Relationship. Oh, God. How much time did you spend with God? Gotta go now, Mark. See, you can't, you've heard me say this before, and I want to repeat this. One of the tricks the ego uses to keep you asleep is someone will ask you something like that, and you'll just respond. But if you really want to know what you believe in, look at your actions. So it's pretty paradoxical to tell someone the most important relationship in your life is God when you do what I did my first 10 years, which is give God about 5 or 10 minutes in the morning or in a shower on the way to work. An occasional thought, and then you go to a meeting, you go home. That's not spending time with God, I came to discover. See? Today, if I really want to know what I believe, I look at my actions on a daily basis. I can't imagine leaving my home without spending that much time with that which created me. In my current practice, I have 3 or 4 meditation books I work with. In the 11th step, I was given a great opening. It said, be quick to see where religious people are right. Begin to make use of what they have to offer. And boy, I took that to heart. And over the years, God has sent me down some incredible paths. When I first got into meditation, I ran across some of the books of Thomas Merton. And incredible stuff. He challenged all kinds of belief systems of mine. He talked a lot about quiet, those kinds of things. His words had a profound impact on me. They helped me with my meditation life. They helped me actually with a lot of things. Another man, Eastern, Paramahansa Yogananda, Self-Realization Fellowship. Incredible stuff on meditation. I joined that for a year, and I did their meditation practices. Did them religiously, did them daily. Then for about 2 years, Native American. I was fortunate enough to, when I was in Kerrville, Texas, that there was a Lakota medicine man who was in the area, and I worked with him for 2 years and got reconnected to Mother Earth. And here's the thing I always tell people about all these practices. I do all this along with, not instead of. I was just talking to some pals of mine on the way over here tonight. I know a lot of people, they'll do this work, they get up to this 11th step, and pretty soon they're pulled out by religion, and most of them, not all of them, most of them that I know have gotten drunk. I do it along with, never instead of. You follow me? There's incredible stuff out there. This is my experience. You're not going to find out much about God, prayer, and meditation in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're sandbox here, right? We're kindergarten. Go to the people who got the PhDs. You know, you want to know about meditation, you go sit across from a monk that's been doing it 30 years. Right? You want to know about prayer, go talk to some Catholic priest that's been doing it 40 years. Or a nun. That's the kind of guy I am. See, I'm still a thief. You got something I want, I'll go get it. Man, and I started going to talk to these people. I'd hear different tapes. I'd get a hold of different tapes of people in AA. And I'd hear some stuff, man, the bells would start chiming. I'd hunt that person down. And I had one question for him. Here's what it is. What did you do to have that experience, to be able to say what you said? Because, see, that's all I can offer anyone. That's all any of us in AA will ever offer each other. The only question anyone I've ever worked with should ever ask me is, what did you do to have that experience? And then I share with them what I did, and then if they're willing to do it, so be it. You follow me? See, the spiritual life's not a theory. I got to live it. These practices allow us to have this experience, but no one can have it for you. You got to decide how much of God you want to know. See, you go to the ocean with a thimble, you're going to get a thimble full of water. How much of God do you want? And there was a part of me that could not be filled. I tell you, I really, sometimes, some of you can probably relate to this. I'll be sitting in meditation, and my brat, I told you about my brat, right? He says to me, what if this is just all a farce and there is no God? You know, little neat thoughts like that in the middle of the silence, right? You know, and of course, my answer to that simple, I don't care if it is a farce or an illusion. My life's never been better, so have a good day, Brett, right? But there comes a time when you got to decide how much of God do you want to know. See, because you do not experience God with your mind. To experience God, you must be out of your mind. You experience God with a part of you that already knows God. See? All that's happened to me over the years, I'm not one iota closer to God than I was in my last drunk. All that's happened is, as a result of a lot of work with 1 through 9, the disciplines of 10, 11, is I'm awake, aware, mindful, and conscious of that which is closer to me than breathing. I'm immersed in water, and I'm never not immersed in water, nor am I ever separated from. That's all that's happened. See? You know, it's like I tell people, these people that say, well, God keeps me sober, right? I say, well, let me ask you a question. Has your concept of God changed from when you came in? No. Well, why? Why didn't he keep you sober then? Maybe there's something else going on here relative to you being sober. And, of course, what I'm trying to get him to understand is you and I stay sober and experience the death of self by staying in fit spiritual condition. And our beautiful book gave us some very clear instructions on how to do that. So, this morning when I walk out the door after probably an hour, hour and 15 minutes, and then I'm a runner and I run. I've learned over the years, by the way, this is about your ego. I take acts that my ego hates. One of them right now is I'm running in the morning about 6:30 when it's dark and it's cold. And my ego just hates it. I get up and, you know, it's just things like, you'll be the only one there. Saw the Weather Channel, it's 32. You're going to get a cold. You know, just... And I just kind of smile, and I get in my car, and I go, and you know, see, I told you, no one's here. But I've learned over the years, I need to take acts to disempower my ego, if you will. I made a statement before that the ego is as mysterious and powerful as God himself as far as you're concerned. You cannot beat your ego. You know, how many of you got a year or less? Raise your hands. Go to a meeting every day. Work closely with your sponsor. Work the steps. You know why? Because what you're up against has more power than anything you can bring to bear against it. Anything. That's why if you knew all these things we tell you in AA, that's why. You don't have a prayer because you have no power. You are sound asleep, dreaming you are awake. Get to a meeting every day. Work with that sponsor. Read that book. Write that inventory. Go make those amends. You know, there's got to be reasons why our recovery rate's what it is. And I know what it is. It's our ego. Power of the ego. Talk about the 10th step a little bit. The 10th step to me is about the line of the will. There's all kinds of spiritual practices in the 10th step. 2 pages of instructions. Most of the time in meetings of AA, I will hear about the first paragraph. And I told you about a man who gave a talk on the 10th and 11th step and made me realize I didn't know anything about the 10th and 11th step. When you get to the 10th step, the big book uses a phraseology. It says, Mark, you've entered the world of the spirit. Now, if you're inquisitive like me, that's a great thing to work with. What do they mean? What does that mean? This thought, this idea of finishing amends brings you to the 10th step. You've entered the world of the Spirit. Here's my experience. When you do the work of 4 through 9 and finish all your amends and there is no past, the world of the Spirit is you have the capacity to be present to this moment, which is the only place you have conscious contact. And I do mean present, all of you. Your mind's here, your body's here, your emotions are here, you're present to the moment. That's the world of the Spirit. You are aware of the fact that you're a spiritual being having a human experience. You are awakened to that as a result of the action that you took in those first 9 steps. And it goes on to talk about, as a result of having entered the world of the Spirit, the fact that we know we're a spiritual being having a human experience, that we're not our human experience. There's a lot more going on. It goes on to say that your whole function now is to grow an understanding of effectiveness about this world of the Spirit stuff. And then they're going to go on and give us some practical tools. Here's one. Watch. The way I begin to practice with the 10th and 11th step is I would take one word. I took the word watch. I work with watch for 6 months. Here's what that means. You literally begin to watch yourself having the human experience. You begin to watch yourself move into fear, and you move back again, line of the will. God, remove the fear. Remind me what you'd have me be, your child. I work with one word, 6 months. Watch for what? Selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And as you begin to wake up, you can watch yourself. See, because you no longer are yourself. You follow me? The book in the 3rd step, with God's help, I can be rid of self. By the time you get to the 10th step, you have a sense there's a lot more going on than what you used to believe. I call it the observer. Call it whatever you will. There's a part of me now that observes me having the human experience. Watch. Ask. I spent another 6 months working with one word. Ask. Powerful things to practice. The way that I do that is I take a 3x5 card, I laminate, and whatever I'm practicing, I write on the 3x5 card. So as I begin to understand watch, then that becomes automatic. Then I moved into ask. Ask God for what? To remind me who and what I am. Then I work with the word turn. Turn to someone I can help. See? Get the force away from you. The eagles gather where the mind goes. If your mind goes into self, you'll pull this energy in. Turn out of yourself. See? Cease. Cease fighting anything or anybody, even alcohol. Think about that. Think about the implications of that sentence in the 10th step. Ceased fighting anything or anybody, even alcohol. You can't practice that with self intact, because you're going to fight anything that doesn't give you what, quote, you yourself thinks it needs. What an incredible thing to practice. Cease fighting anything or anyone. These kids have another saying that they like to use. It's called whatever. Great. I used to hate that word. I realized how spiritual that word is. Whatever. You know, can't make it tonight. Whatever. You know, got to let you go on the job. Whatever. See? I have a banner above my altar. Whatever. But it's an incredible practice to cease fighting anything or anybody, see, even alcohol. Then the book talks about what's called a position of neutrality around alcohol, and I've discovered around a lot of things. You can practice operating in a position of neutrality. What does that mean then? It means you get to respond to life and not react, see? The position of neutrality. And it goes on the 10th step to say, is this your experience? And if it's not your experience, you missed something. Go back and redo it again. And then as far as I can tell, the only place in our book where it gives us a warning, it's easy to let up in the spiritual program of action, rest on your laurels. For me, my laurels are what I did yesterday. Not last year. I fell into a trap, and you don't very seldom you ever hear me say this. Here was the trap. When I came in, you see what I'm saying? I'm trying to live off my laurels, what I did yesterday. I have to make things simple. My body cannot live off the food I ate 2 weeks ago. I cannot live off what I did yesterday with God. Give me this day my daily bread. I die each night, I'm born each morning. And I'm responsible for the practices and the disciplines on a daily basis. And I get to reap the results of those. It goes on to talk about then that you and I are given a daily reprieve based on one thing and one thing only. How many of you relapsed before? Raise your hands. Oh, yeah. If you ever wondered why, I'm going to give you the solution. You never need to wonder again. You were not in fit spiritual condition. That's it. It was not because of her. Wasn't because of the job. Wasn't because Dad died. It was because you were not in fit spiritual condition. That's it. If you ever relapse again, it's because you're not in fit spiritual condition. Do the work in 1 through 9. You'll just get a taste of what it is to be in fit spiritual condition. I'm sorry, but as far as I know from this book, there's no other way to do it. Just going to meetings and not drinking will not do it. You go to 6 a day. Won't matter. See? It won't matter. And then it goes on to talk about the vision of God's will. It talks about these thoughts need to go with me constantly throughout my day. And the book promises me now I can exercise my willpower along this line. What line? A line devoid of self. That's the line. Along this line. What's interesting is in the third step, we made a decision to turn our will over to God. In the tenth step, we have it back, right? Because it's a will that's devoid of self. The more you work with these practices and the more you work with these disciplines. And then the big book goes on to talk about you and I have been given a new sixth sense. You know, you guys can have some fun in your meetings here. You know when they ask that thing, is anyone have a topic? I'll give you some new ones to have some fun with. Do you have a topic? Yes. Share your experience with your new sixth sense. What? Yeah, share your experience with your new sixth sense, right? Do you have a topic? Yeah. Share your experience with what it's like to have entered the world of the Spirit. It's all in here. See? It's all in here. But you have to ask yourself a question. I've been going to meetings, not that long, a little over 18 years. So I say to myself, self, why aren't we talking about this kind of stuff? What is the deal? Why are so many of our meetings devoted to fear and right? Why aren't we talking about the power of God in our lives? Why aren't we talking about entering the world of the Spirit, God's vision, sixth sense? Why aren't we talking about meditation? Those are great questions. I have a theory. Here's what it is. We talk about what we experience. So if I haven't done a bunch of work with 1 through 9 and I'm working with 10 and 11, then I can't talk about what I'm not having experience with. Is that, you understand? That was my experience in my first 10 years when I didn't have experience with doing 4 through 9 repetitively and really working with the disciplines of 10 and 11. See, I'm going to share with you what I'm experiencing. Don't miss out on this stuff. Don't miss out on this stuff. You know, over the years, I've studied a lot of different religions and philosophies, and it's all in our big book. It's all in this incredible book, these first 174 pages. You don't have to go anywhere. And it is so specific, and it is so clear-cut, and written in a language you and I can understand. And you can have what our book says. The great fact is this, and nothing less. You've had a deep and effective, revolutionary spiritual experience, and in that you come to know God. You come to know your true self. You begin to experience the death of self. Your heart will overfill with the love of God in your heart and in your life. You can learn to be present to the moment. Being present to the moment does so many things for you. You take nothing for granted. A bite of food, a glass of water, people you love. What powerful things can come to you when you are present to the moment. See, the ego takes everything for granted. Everything, right? And gets bored quickly. Buy a new car a week later, right? Color, you know, you're living with someone that you love dearly, and you know your head does all this stuff around them, right? As far as I can tell, I don't know, I listen to tapes all the time. As far as I can tell, the most enlightened man I've ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous is Chuck C. You listen to his tapes sometimes. That guy said something I didn't understand. I heard this early on in sobriety. He talked about him and his wife. He talked about he'd married that woman I don't know how many years. And he said he got up every day and there's this brand new woman in front of him. What is he talking about? That don't make any sense. Well, it makes a lot of sense when you're present to now, because you die each night and you wake up the next day and you're present to now. And when you're present to now, it's all holy. It's all sacred. It is all incredible. Follow me? You don't take anything for granted. Because you know not when you'll get called. See, I went out to spend those last 2 weeks with my mother. She had Alzheimer's, and almost everybody and everything terrified her. And as a result of amends and spending time with her, I'd go sit with her for 2 or 3 hours a day. And I do mean almost everybody and everything. My older brother and his wife are the only two people who could be around with her. And I could sit around with her. And just sit in the silence. And every once in a while she'd turn and she'd say, "Who are you?" You know? And then she would, then, you know, maybe an hour or so would go by. And she'd look at me and she'd go, "Mark, how are you?" I mean, just to be present to that, see? From the time my mother passed away to this moment, I've only had one emotion, incredible joy. Incredible joy that I grew to love that woman so much, just as she was. The other thing about being present to the moment is this, and I'm going to close. There isn't anyone that's in my life that has to change anything at all about themselves, ever. I love everybody in my life and everybody I meet exactly the way you are, because that's how God loves me. And if there's any part of us that wants anyone to change, that is about nothing but self. That is not about love. And when you can begin to go through life like that, you are a free man. You are a free woman. You can begin to understand how God loves us. See? God, don't miss out on this thing. Don't miss out on this thing. If you've been sober for a while and haven't done some work with the steps, consider going back through again. If you're not working with meditation, you've been sober for a while, consider that. I throw those things out for considerations. In a universe in which I have a creator whose power is love, who manifests as love, that power will never interfere with my choice, my free will. And there came a day, though, when I decided to go to the ocean and I wanted a lot more than a thimble of God. One thing, anyone who knows me fairly well, if I died today, I'm a free man. One last thought that I never understood. Death always scared me. I continually did the work in 1 through 9 and work with the disciplines of 10, 11, 12, and as a result of that, I realized the illusion to death. And the funny thing is, when you get prepared to die, because you recognize it's an illusion, now you can embrace life at its fullest and become so precious. Minute by minute, day by day. Thank you all. God bless you.